and all Nick could muster was, "It's your brother." Lori slammed the phone down, woke her daughter, Rachel, and piled her into the car for the 5-minute drive, all the while begging, "Please let him just be injured." A dark vehicle was pulling away from the front of the house, and she knew. Lori bounded up the back steps where she was met by her mother. Terry fell into her arms as she managed to shriek through halted speech and a torrent of tears, "Johnny's gone. My Johnny's gone." After hugs and tears, Terry said, "We need to tell Kevin and Tammy." "I can't. I just can't do it." Lori called her sister, Tammy, in Vermont first, because it was late. Kevin was 2 hours behind. When Tammy answered, Lori asked, "Is David right there with you?" She didn't have to say anything else. Tammy knew. She had seen the news but waited for Lori to continue. "We lost John today." Tammy fell to the floor where David found her curled into the fetal position. Rattled, Lori hung up to call Kevin. It was 9:30 Colorado time. When Kevin answered, Lori wasn't as composed as she tried to be and blurted, "I have bad news. We lost John today." She gave him time to absorb her words, but he had collapsed onto the floor, unable to speak. Kevin's wife, Connie, came on the line, and when she heard the news, said, "I have to go. Kevin needs me," and hung up. The tidal wave of raw pain coursed toward Michigan to an unsuspecting Gene and his wife, Tess. The Air Force notification team had trouble finding their house, so by the time they arrived, Gene and Tess already knew. Gene passed away in January of 2004, but Tess remembers that night vividly. "We were waiting. I don't know exactly why they couldn't find our address, so by the time they came to us, it was already late. They came to the door, and they knew we already knew, but they had to tell us anyway. Gene was standing in front of me, and he about, even though we knew, he still about dropped to the floor." Starting the next day, and for more than a week following, while the world continued to spin, time moved in slow motion for the Chapman family as they converged on Fayetteville, North Carolina. The 2-4 held a memorial service in a giant hangar on Pope AFB. The cavernous building was standing room only, filled with a sea of red berets and blue uniforms as Colonel Rodriguez took the podium to speak of John and his bravery in facing the jaws of death. The audience was spellbound, and as the family began meeting many of John's comrades, they started to truly understand the caliber of men John worked alongside. They were cut from the same cloth as he. Two of those men, Technical Sergeant John Gendron and Staff Sergeant Scott Toner, volunteered to escort John's body from Dover AFB in Delaware to his final resting place in Windburg, Pennsylvania. They were honored to flank John on his final mission. Valerie thought she would move back to Windburg to raise her girls near her parents, so she chose to have John buried there instead of in the country's hero's resting place, Arlington National Cemetery. After the memorial service at Pope, everyone traveled en masse to the small Pennsylvania town. Many of John's childhood friends made the 7-hour drive from Connecticut to say their final goodbye. Three of them, Brian Toper, David Rabel, and Michael Tose, traveled together, laughing, crying, and reminiscing about their time with John. By the time they reached Windburg, they had decided that the funeral can't be it. This can't be forever for John. Windburg, with a population of 4,000, was even smaller than John's hometown. But it had the same circle-the-wagons mentality as Windsor Locks. Word spread quickly that John would be laid to rest there, and townsfolk rallied to welcome his family and friends. As mourners quite literally flooded the town, they were greeted by friendly townspeople and American flags lining the streets. 1,000 people passed by John's open casket at William Kissel Funeral Home, while Gendron and Toner took turns standing rigid and solemn next to him. In the outer rooms of the funeral home, and later in the confines of a hotel bar, childhood friends were meeting John's 2-4 brothers for the first time, and they bonded over memories of Chappie. Countless CCT, family, and friends gathered at the hotel's bar, sharing stories of John, raising a glass, and toasting the nation's newest hero, eventually running the bar dry. Brian Toper was one of the throng, and he remembers, "The night before the funeral, we went to a hotel, and a bunch of the guys from the 2-4 were there, and that was our introduction to combat control, to John's other brotherhood. It was overwhelming for me, because these guys were, they're the cream of the crop, and they treated us great. The neat part is that these guys are your friends, somebody else's brother, and even though they may be ordinary people, they are extraordinary in what they do. They're a different breed. And I saw in them what I saw in John. He had no fear. He was bright. He was very smart. Confident. He wasn't arrogant. He wasn't reckless. Yeah, he took risks, but there's a difference between risky and reckless. He didn't fail." David Rabel's takeaway from meeting John's 2-4 teammates was, "It became obvious by listening that he was the exact same Chappie that we knew and loved in childhood." The next morning, over 400 people pressed into St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Church for John's funeral service, including another sea of red berets. John's youngest sister, Tammy, spoke to the congregation about her brother, ending with, "John has always been my hero. Now he's your hero, too." There weren't enough tissues to go around, as Kevin also spoke about growing up with John, how proud he was of him, and how much he'd miss him. Toper and Rabel gave the eulogy. "As young kids, we often played Army or Air Force and dreamed of one day being Green Berets or combat controllers and becoming heroes. After we found out John was a member of the 2-4, we were able to, once again, relive our dreams through him." At the pulpit, Brian recalled, "I remember a conversation I had with him when he spoke of going to Texas for some training. He was always vague when talking about CCT, so when I asked him what kind of training, he responded, 'Military training.' I always hoped that after retirement we'd sit back with a few beers and I could coax more stories from John." As the miles-long procession serpentined to St. Mary Byzantine Catholic Church Cemetery, Rabel recalls, "The military's sense of their community was forever burned in our minds. We saw an elderly man, obviously a veteran, standing in his front yard by his American flag, saluting John as he traveled to his final resting place. People came out to wave flags and show their respect all along the route to the cemetery. As mourners watched the Air Force Honor Guard slowly bring John's casket graveside, a missing man formation flyover by Air Force A-10 Thunderbolts roared overhead. Valerie sat solemnly in the front row, flanked by Madison and Brianna, as Colonel Rodriguez presented her, in honor of John's sacrifice, with the tightly folded flag that had covered her husband's casket. Jean and Terry sat sobbing as they each accepted the flags he presented, listening to him thank them for their sacrifice. They were officially part of a club no one wants to join, and from which there is no escape." As family and friends passed John's casket for their final farewell, some placed flowers, some placed coins. Terry kissed the casket before turning away. Jean held his hand on top as he silently said goodbye. A handful of John's CCT brothers lingered at his side one last time, not wanting to leave. Those tough, hardened warriors hugged and cried before leaving coins and a beret pin on the casket lid, leaning on each other as they turned away. John is buried only 20 miles from Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Shanksville is the tragic resting place of United Flight 93, the fourth and missing plane on 9/11, the day that brought the call for John and his brothers to fight terror in Afghanistan. The beginning of the end for John. Before leaving Windber, Jean spoke with Valerie's father, Jim, about John's gravesite. Jim, who loved John like his own, lives a short walk down the hill from St. Mary's Cemetery, and promised Jean that he would take care of John's plot. To this day, he takes his daily walk to the cemetery where he tends John's grave. Anyone searching for it need only look for the greenest and best-kept site, thanks to Jim Novak and the promise between two dads. The trip back to Connecticut proved therapeutic and productive for John's three friends, Brian, David, and Michael. Since they had decided on the way to Windburr that the funeral couldn't be the end of it for John, they used the trip home to brainstorm about what to do. Determined to keep John's memory from fading into yesterday's news, David recalls, "We tossed around so many ideas, renaming the airport or a street or a stretch of highway. We were all over the place. Then we finally settled on where John's memorial should be, and that led us in the direction of what it should be. It was most fitting to be at Windsor Locks High School by the soccer field where we had all played." Brian adds, "We thought that keeping the memorial in town was the most meaningful, but we also thought, since Chappie wasn't buried in Windsor Locks, or even close by, we wanted a place for people to go and remember him. And we did it for his mom, too." In the end, they accomplished in only 7 balls-to-the-wall months what seasoned organizers couldn't do in a year. David remembers with pride, "For a bunch of unorganized guys, it impressed me what we could do, what a group of people can do, grassroots, when we put the effort together." Brian added, "When you have people that have a common bond, such strong feelings for John, you get it done no matter what. I put more work into that at that time than I did at my job." David agreed. "Yep, me too. And I was new to my job." Michael nodded in agreement as Brian said, "If we weren't working our jobs, we were working on the memorial." Michael quipped, "It almost cost us our jobs and our marriages." Though the latter part was just to emphasize how much time the men put into the memorial. In reality, their wives were totally supportive, because they knew what this project meant, what John meant to their husbands. John's memorial was dedicated on October 19, 2002. Ironically, the same date as the first ground deployments of Operation Enduring Freedom the previous year. It sits at the corner of the soccer field at Windsor Locks High, beside a grove of hardwood trees. The design is simple, a 30-foot-tall flagpole topped with a golden eagle that roosts high above a large boulder. On the boulder is a bronze plaque that reads, "In memory of John A. Chapman, Chappie, WLHS Class of 1983, you will never be forgotten. Fellow student, dedicated athlete, loyal friend, committed family man, true patriot." Members of the 2-4 came, including Kenny Longfritz and another support teammate, Master Sergeant Mike Rizzuto. Kicking off the ceremony, Rizzuto slowly raised the American flag as Longfritz unfurled it from its triangle. Standing next to the flagpole, hands over their hearts, were John's childhood friends, their upward gaze locked on the flag as it rose over their heads. Their dream, their blood, sweat, and tears, their tribute to John, had come to glorious fruition. As the flag met the golden eagle and the last notes of the Star-Spangled Banner faded, Brian Toper stepped to the podium to dedicate the memorial. Those who never met John will only know him as an American hero. But in school, he was Chappie, a fellow classmate, a student, a teammate, and a friend. He had a wonderful zest for life and a firm commitment to teamwork. In dedicating the memorial, Brian stated, "Having this here is fitting, so people can come to talk, laugh, or cry out loud. Without individuals like John, we would not be able to sleep peacefully at night." In a moving tribute, childhood and high school friend Bill Brooks credited John for changing the course of his life with unconditional friendship and encouragement. "I was a painfully shy kid. Even throughout most of high school, I couldn't talk to anyone." Over time, John coaxed Bill into believing in himself, so much so that he went on to be a chef who travels the world speaking to large groups. "I don't know if he even knew he was helping me all those years ago, but he helped me get to where I am now. After high school, we kind of went in and out of each other's lives, but the times that he came back into my life are the times that I needed him there. I can't imagine how my life would have been without John in it. Colonel Ken Rodriguez then took the platform to offer his tribute to John, closing with, "This is what it's all about. This great American town. This is what John was fighting for." The ceremony ended with a lone bagpiper, Pipe Major Patrick Whelan of the Connecticut State Police Pipes and Drums Unit, standing behind the memorial, his pipes echoing "Amazing Grace" over the fields. At that point in 2002, the Chapman family didn't know the truth of what happened on Taker Gar, but each one of them had a sixth sense that there was much more to the story than they had been told. The Navy had immediately added John's name, the only non-SEAL, to their wall of honor in Virginia Beach. Why, the family wondered, would they do that if he'd merely played a minor role on the mission? And why were there debates within the Air Force as to the level of medal they would award him? Air Force Cross? Medal of Honor? Ultimately, he was posthumously awarded the Air Force Cross on January 10, 2003. But the debate over the award level created more questions for the family. Time passed, and though John's family continued to mull over trickles of new information, life pushed them forward. In early 2005, they received word that the Navy was going to rename a ship after John. The MV Merlin, a 670-foot cargo container and roll-on, roll-off ship owned by Sealift Incorporated and leased by the Navy's Military Sealift Command, was renamed MV Tech Sergeant John A. Chapman in a sunny ceremony on April 8, 2005, at the Military Ocean Terminal, Sunny Point, North Carolina. It was fitting that the ship, a munitions vessel, would be named for John, a combat controller whose profession, among all the elite of special operations, relied on those munitions to change the course of battles and lives. The publication of this book will be the latest in a long line of honors bestowed upon John and his legacy. On June 14, 2006, during the 60th anniversary celebration at Lackland AFB honoring enlisted heroes, Terry attended the unveiling of the Chapman Training Complex, home of the 326th Training Squadron. Many more honors have come, including a nephew namesake, John Chapman Longfritz, multiple renamings of streets, an FOB, forward operating base, and a score of tattoos. John's three childhood friends were right. The funeral wasn't it for him, his name, and his legacy. Chapter 25. John's original Air Force Cross would have remained just that, the nation's second highest award for selfless action and heroism, had it not been for chance. Secretary of the Air Force Deborah Lee James strolled across her office, enjoying a few free moments in an otherwise busy daily schedule that was blocked out in 10-minute increments, controlled more by her handlers than herself. The 15th of May 2015 was a beautiful spring morning, and the windows of her office on the fourth floor of the Pentagon's desirable E-Wing afforded million-dollar views of the nation's capital and monuments. She liked to joke that the Air Force sat above the Secretary of Defense's office, directly below on the third floor. Dressed in a vibrant red business suit, she felt a bit of color added to the muted tones of most Pentagon staffers, she chanced to pick up a copy of the Air Force Times, the service's weekly newspaper, and sat down to check the voice of her people. The press is a great source of information and gauge of what people are thinking, she reminded those who viewed journalists as the enemy. Savoring the momentary respite, she leafed through the pages, and an article caught her eye, titled, "He Saved 80 Lives, Why Not the Medal of Honor?" It recounted the story of two combat controllers. The first was Senior Airman Dustin Temple, who delivered 80 Americans and Afghans from death the previous September while exposing himself repeatedly to direct enemy fire as he killed 18 enemy combatants. The other was Staff Sergeant Robert Gutierrez, who saved the life of his wounded Green Beret team leader during an ambush, only to be shot in the chest himself. His lungs collapsed, yet he refused to get off the radio and stop calling airstrikes, some within 30 feet of his location, thereby saving his entire Special Forces team. Instead, a Green Beret medic jammed a syringe into his chest to reinflate his lungs, twice. The article asked a valid but pointed question. What does it take for an airman to get the Medal of Honor? Looking up from the article, Secretary James was struck by the sentiment. That's a damn good point, she thought. As her next meeting swept into her office, she tore out the page, scribbled in the margin, "What does it take?" and gave the paper to her aide, an Air Force colonel, instructing him to have her staff look into the matter. Thus began the 3-year journey of the most thoroughly investigated and documented Medal of Honor in history. When the Secretary of the Air Force asks a question, an army of staffers activates immediately. With a bit more guidance from the SECAF, the task morphed into a review of all Air Force Silver Stars and Air Force Crosses awarded since 9/11 to see if any might be worthy of upgrade based on new information. After months of investigation across the entire force, her query was answered. Late that summer, she received a call from Lieutenant General Brad Heitholt, commander of Air Force Special Operations Command, AFSOC. He had one case, the only one in the Air Force that met her criteria for reinvestigation. "There may be some injustice here," he told the Air Force's most senior civilian leader. "He was alive, and we have technical proof that he was." "Great," she told him. "Let's do this." At Heitholt's direction, AFSOC's 24th Special Operations Wing, responsible for all special tactics squadrons and combat control, established a dedicated team to investigate the Air Force's first potential Medal of Honor since Vietnam. The air team consulted Air Force targeting, including the Air Force's chief targeter on duty during the battle, and intelligence analysts, and submitted their video assessment to the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the nation's foremost imagery experts, who validated the team's findings. They also pulled from Anaconda After Action Reports, JSOC's official investigation into the events of March 3rd and 4th, 2002, witness statements, John's autopsy, consulting the doctor who conducted the original autopsy in addition to a forensic pathologist, and new interviews with surviving AFO members. It provided Lieutenant General Heitholt an airtight case. John had earned the nation's highest award. Concurrently, JSOC held a special awards board and also endorsed an upgrade for John's medal, starting a separate but equally important chain of decisions within the special operations community that would end with U.S. Special Operations Command's endorsement of his upgrade. Throughout the year that followed her tasking, I kept asking about progress on John. When AFSOC's recommendation finally arrived on Secretary James's desk on June 9, 2016, she signed it and forwarded her recommendation to the Secretary of Defense the same day. Still, for the next 2 years, AFSOC and the Air Force continued investigating and validating their findings while simultaneously fighting with certain leaders from SEAL Team 6 who could not abide the fact they'd left a man for dead. The contestation rose to senior levels of the Navy and represented the first time in the history of the medal that one service attempted to obstruct the submission of another, according to experts on the Medal of Honor. Footnote. According to the Pentagon's foremost Medal of Honor staffing expert, John Chapman earned not one, but two Medals of Honor that morning. The first, by charging and destroying the machine gun bunker ahead of the SEALs and saving their lives, and the second when he protected the CSAR helicopter. Each action rose to the level of the nation's highest honor, but the Air Force chose to pursue only a single medal, preferring, one presumes, to combine his actions into one irrefutable package. For two men, the need to protect the unit's image overrode the facts of John having survived after the SEALs retreated. Two officers drove the Navy's contestation. The, at the time, current commander of ST-6, a man known by the initials JW, and Admiral Tim Szymanski, now head of all naval special warfare. Szymanski was the man both Pete Blaber and Jimmy Rees contend was the root source of the mission's botched planning and execution. In the course of time and politics, Air Force Secretary James was replaced when the new administration swept into office in January 2017. Her pledge to see John's medal come to fruition was taken up by others, among them and notably Deputy Secretary of Defense Bob Work. By summer 2017, it was clear that Chapman's medal was headed for the White House. In one of his final emails as the DepSec Def, Bob Work wrote to new Secretary of the Air Force Heather Wilson and Chief of Staff General David Goldfein, dated July 12, 2017, entitled White Smoke. It stated, "Team Air Force, I'm happy to inform you that the Secretary has approved the upgrade of Tech Sergeant Chapman's AF Cross to the Medal of Honor, citing both Material Finding 1 and 2. As previously agreed, Material Finding 2 will be discussed only in the classified portion of the award. The citation will make mention that Chappie fought on until he succumbed to his wounds." After extensive analysis, the FBI concluded that a firefight continued on the top of the hill for an hour after the team exfilled down the mountain. Although they could not conclusively determine whether it was blue on red or a red on red engagement, the secretary concluded it was blue on red based on the following factors. 1. The team, SEALs, never conclusively determined Chappie was dead. 2. Tech Sergeant Chapman's body was found in a different location than indicated by the team. 3. He was wounded 7 times and had expended almost all of his ammo, indicating an extended fight. 4. The last part of the engagement occurred in daylight and close ranges. The secretary noted the reports of an M4 and AK-47 are distinctly different, and therefore does not find the explanation of an extended red-on-red firefight plausible. We are working the package now. Thanks for your patience and perseverance. May Tech Sergeant Chapman and his family rest more peacefully once they are told. Aim high. Best, Bob." He retired 2 days later, a stalwart for John's full actions to the end. On October 24, 2017, the Office of the Secretary of Defense informed the Chief of Staff and Secretary of the Air Force that John's Medal of Honor had been forwarded to the President of the United States. Finally, on March 26, 2018, President Trump called Valerie with the news. It was her birthday.
Chapter 26, the 22nd through the 24th, August 2018. The White House, Pentagon Hall of Heroes, and Air Force Memorial, through Lori's eyes. 16 years ago, I knew. I knew that my brother John's actions were greater than we were told. I knew he didn't die right away. My intuition was finally validated when John was awarded the Medal of Honor at the White House. It's been a long and emotional roller coaster these last 16 years, but to witness my brother being awarded our nation's highest military honor left me speechless. To think it all began when then-Secretary of the Air Force Deborah Lee James asked a simple question: what does it take for an airman to receive the Medal of Honor? The answer took more than 2 frustrating years of intense investigation, culminating in a week of extraordinary celebrations of John's life, the first of which was the August 22, 2018 White House ceremony. I was struck by the elegance of the East Room. The white walls, golden curtains, and crystal chandeliers made it regal, the perfect room for a special honor. Soft light filling the room through the front windows of the White House lent a timeless air. Row after row of gold chairs curved around the stage, each one with a beautifully crafted program laid upon its white cushioned seat. The silence of the room was solemn, but not sad. The small stage was equally fitting, with another golden curtain serving as the backdrop for three flags: our American flag, the Congressional flag, and that of our United States Air Force. As our family gathered, the mood became more celebratory when the realization set in that we were finally going to see John honored appropriately. We talked and laughed, nervous excitement pouring from us. Tears filled my eyes as I stole a moment to take in the entire space. Dozens of media cameras stood silently on tripods at the back, poised to capture this historic event. White House staff and Air Force protocol were buzzing around, making sure everything was perfect. And as the guests started filing in, I could feel the energy in the room rise as each person found a seat and chatted excitedly with those around them. The room was filled with people John loved, people who loved him back. So many of his childhood friends came to watch him be honored, marveling that the little boy they grew up with, the young man they shared laughter, tears, and secrets with, was an American hero. His special tactics brothers were there en masse. Men in blue dress uniforms, the controllers obvious in their parachute wings and rows of medals, and former CCT in crisp dark suits sat shoulder to shoulder, just as they had when they served with John at one time, a lifetime ago. They, more than many, understood the magnitude of what was about to happen. I sat between my son, John, and husband, Kenny, in the front row to the left of center stage, and kept checking my watch, excited for the ceremony to begin. I looked back at my brother, Kevin. He and his wife, Connie, were beaming with anticipation, while my nephew and niece, Jake and Sierra, smiled with moistened eyes, eager to be witness to their uncle's honor. As I turned toward the front, my mom, Brianna, Madison, and Val were escorted to their seats. They had just met with President Trump, and their smiles spoke volumes. Mom later told Kenny she was ecstatic that the president had signed the medal certificate and the citation in front of them, and after Val presented him with the photo of John and the Afghan girl, he looked at the photo, then at Mom, and said, "He looks like you." Those four little words meant the world to her. The first notes of "Hail to the Chief" signaled for all to rise as the president's arrival was announced. My heartbeat quickened as I rose. It wasn't the president who spurred my heart, but the knowledge that his presence beckoned John's medal ever closer. When he stepped on stage and turned to the audience, I was in awe, being only a few feet away from him, the man who signed John's Medal of Honor package, and who was about to present what I knew John earned. President Trump stood at the podium and spoke in soft, soothing tones. I dropped my gaze. I knew the story he would tell. I knew how John's citation would read, and I didn't want to hear it again, not then. My mind drifted off to happy times with John, fun times that I hold dear in my heart. Times when the four of us got silly. Times when I thought we would all grow old together and reminisce. It was a quick interlude, but one that filled me with happiness and peace. I felt John was with us in that room. As the reading of the citation came to an end, I released those memories to the heavens so I could be present in the moment of the presentation. Watching Valerie accept John's Medal of Honor did not make me any prouder of him than I already was, but it was a moment that filled me with immense delight and satisfaction after 16 years of wanting it to happen. It felt surreal. There we were, in the White House, witnessing my brother being honored by the president, his actions fully acknowledged. What I'd wanted and fought for was finally happening. At times, I couldn't focus on what was being said. It was somewhat a blur, but I watched with a jubilant heart. Val was gracious as she accepted John's medal and thanked the president, who motioned for Madison, Brianna, and my mom to join them on the stage. Every guest rose for a standing ovation, but they weren't standing for those on stage. They were standing for John, for what he earned, and they were standing because he couldn't. The applause, the standing ovation, and the gratitude were all for John and what he meant to each one of us. I was joyous at having witnessed my brother being awarded our nation's highest military honor. As his sister, I wanted his actions acknowledged. I wanted people to know that he died how he lived, selflessly. John was a hero to countless unnamed people throughout his life, but it was his actions on the 4th of March 2002 that propelled him into American hero status. I've always been his proud big sister, but the 22nd of August 2018 wasn't about pride in him. It was about being grateful that his selfless actions on that fateful day had finally and forever been recognized. He wouldn't have cared about recognition, but I do. I care because of my mom. I care because it's right. And I care because of truth. Witnessing John being awarded the Medal of Honor gave me the greatest satisfaction. But it was the ceremonies at the Pentagon's Hall of Heroes and the Air Force Memorial that deeply touched me emotionally, because they were to celebrate John, not just acknowledge his actions. At John's induction ceremony into the Hall of Heroes on the 23rd of August, I saw countless men who trained and worked with John, men who were there because they wanted to see him being honored the way they have honored him all these years. I was thrilled to finally be able to talk about John, about my brother, and when my mom and I spoke, I saw how our words affected them all. As my husband said afterward, many of them must have been passing around an onion because there were quite a few tears filling the eyes of those tough men, and it touched my heart that they care so deeply about John. The 24th of August ceremony at the Air Force Memorial was even more incredible. As our motorcade made its way to the memorial, I saw countless people, many in uniform, hurrying to get there on time. One officer stopped and saluted as we passed. An officer. It made me cry to see such respect and honor. The Air Force had expected 700 airmen and other military personnel to attend the ceremony, and I later found out there were over 1,200 in attendance. As I turned to look behind me, the sea of red berets, blue uniforms, and excited faces extended past my line of sight. And when John's name was unveiled on the memorial wall, the sole name listed for Afghanistan, my heart burst with pride and I couldn't hold back the tears. What I wouldn't give to have him there instead of his name, but I am so proud. As if the previous honors weren't enough, after John's name was unveiled, the ceremony continued as he was posthumously promoted to the rank of Master Sergeant. He would be humbled. And as the ceremony concluded, the throng of John's military brothers and sisters made their way to the foot of the Air Force Memorial to perform not only the very first memorial push-ups at that location, but also, probably, the largest contingent. The mass of brave men and women were, quite literally, side by side by side, as they rose and fell to the called cadence. Who would have thought the boy I grew up with would someday be honored in so many ways? If John were alive today, he would quietly say, "I was just doing my job, what had to be done." Well, my dear brother, you went above and beyond just doing your job. You deserve this honor. You earned it. It makes me sad that we won't be able to sit around when we're old and gray, beers in hand, talking about things you couldn't tell us. But I am honored to have grown up with you, one of the Chapman Four. Echoing Tammy's words at your funeral, You have always been my hero. Now you're America's hero, too. And though I'm in no hurry, I look forward to seeing you again, so we can finally have that talk. My heart aches as I miss you every single day. I love you forever.
Epilogue. John Chapman's quest for challenge lit upon one of the most selective and certainly most unique special operations forces in the world. And like most young men entering an SOF discipline, he was not fully aware of how unique his chosen field was until after he was a full-fledged member. When he cross-trained in 1989, there were fewer than 300 combat controllers in the world. Over the course of America's longest-running war, CCT has grown to nearly 600 operators. Still only a fraction of sister service SOFs such as the Green Berets, Rangers, and SEALs, who number in the thousands, yet the ratios are appropriate. Controllers continue to operate as lone warriors among the teams of men they join and protect in war. For those aspiring to become a combat controller, the pipeline has evolved as well, just as 21st century warfare itself has advanced. What was essentially a year plus of hell and trial by fire from day one for John Chapman and the others of his day has morphed into a 2.5-year journey, including an entire year of advanced skills training after graduation from combat control school. The sophistication of instruction and the preparation of candidates for the challenges ahead of them are some of the improvements. Yet attrition remains 75% due to the punishing nature of the training and exacting standards demanded. Despite its name and combat focus, there is a second and arguably more valuable role combat control fulfills, that of humanitarian. With this secondary mission, CCT is the only deliberately dual-role SOF force. In 1978, three Panama-based CCT were given a no-notice task to hop a plane for Guyana in late November, only to find themselves amid the evil and senseless carnage of the Jonestown Massacre. As the only men capable of single-handedly spearheading the body recovery and providing situational awareness to the highest levels of government back in the U.S., they spent their Thanksgiving among the hundreds of dead in order to return the 918 victims to their loved ones on American soil. CCT has gone on to reprise this role as the world's first of the first responders time and again. For Americans, this was most evident during Hurricane Katrina in 2005. When CCT from both Air National Guard Special Tactics Squadrons led the rescue, staging, and recovery effort for thousands of homeless and desperate Louisianans, turning Interstate 10 into a major heliport and surging small Zodiac boats to isolated victims. CCT then repeated the feat during Hurricanes Rita and Ike in 2005 and 2008, respectively. In the Indian Ocean, shortly after Christmas turned to Boxing Day in 2004, the third largest earthquake ever recorded unleashed a tsunami that devastated multiple countries. John Chapman's former unit, the 320th Special Tactics Squadron, responded to the worst affected and most remote Indonesian province of Aceh to deliver aid and assist with rescues where the massive quake-generated wave crested 100 feet. And washed away entire villages. The most significant humanitarian combat control operation, however, took place closer to home and earned a distinction no other U.S. military enlisted person has ever received. Tony Travis, a career CCT Master Sergeant at Hurlburt's 23rd Special Tactics Squadron, was called into work on the evening of January 12, 2010. After a 7.0 earthquake rocked and devastated the impoverished island nation of Haiti. 2 million people were affected in the capital of Port-au-Prince alone. Packed and ready to go within hours, Tony led the first forces on the ground, arriving at 1536 the next day. Their mission? Secure, open, and control Toussaint Louverture International Airport. 8 combat controllers, equipped with only their portable radios and 2 ATVs, cleared and established control within 28 minutes, meeting the self-imposed CCT standard and launching their first plane with 2 minutes to spare. Tony started his stopwatch the instant he stepped onto Haitian soil. From their ATVs and a scavenged folding table, the men ran the airport amid international chaos for the next 13 days, when they were relieved by Air Force air traffic controllers. Armed with a personal letter from President René Garcia Préval granting Tony personal control of all Haitian airspace, CCT landed the more than 250 aircraft converging daily from 50-plus nations, exceeding the expected capacity of the airfield by 1,400%. The expert, austere airfield operators managed to shoehorn planes and helicopters onto every inch of the airport with zero incidents. Additionally, when more CCT arrived, they surveyed, established, and controlled 30 remote landing and drop zones for aerial delivery of 150,000 pounds of humanitarian supplies. A man with extensive combat experience, including an unfortunate knife kill. I fucked up clearing a building and was forced to go to my knife when I couldn't get to my secondary pistol. He was profoundly impacted by his experiences in Haiti. You do a lot of things in combat, but never see the results. In Haiti, the positive feedback was immediate. For him, delivering global first responders, sending out the injured, and bringing order to the chaotic airfield was the essence of combat control. It's what we do. Go in, set up, and control airspace. I don't believe any other organization in the world can do that without advance notice. For leading the effort to establish a beachhead amid the anarchy of a global response converging on a single ill-equipped and devastated runway in one of the most impoverished nations in the world, Tony Travis was recognized as one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people of the year. Like Tony Travis, John Chapman was already one of the most elite warriors in the world, but chose to take another ultimate step toward being the best, placing himself in the top 10% of all CCT. And, as with the select handful of Green Berets and Rangers who try out for Delta Force, or their counterparts in the Navy, drawn from the ranks of the vanilla SEAL teams who volunteer to join Team 6, John successfully ascended to the most elite unit in the Air Force, by some measures, the world, and joined the 2-4. Throughout its history, CCT has accomplished unique firsts in and out of combat, particularly using parachutes, their favored means of insertion. In 1955 and 56, America was building a presence in Antarctica and used Air Force aircraft to airdrop and land on the continent. During this expansion, the first site to be built up was situated on the precise South Pole. Staging from Christchurch, New Zealand, USAF C-124 Globemasters ferried equipment and supplies to the austere environment. When the uncontrolled cargo parachute drops began failing and missing their target drop zones, DZs, damaging significant portions of critical and specialized equipment, the call went out for someone with expertise in precision airdrops. In stepped Technical Sergeant Richard J. Patton, an airman with merely 31 parachute jumps. At exactly 0154 hours, Greenwich Mean Time, Sunday, 25th November 1956, at an altitude of 2,000 feet, he jumped from a C-124 christened the State of New Jersey. 1 minute later, he drifted to the ice to become the first person to make or even attempt a jump at the South Pole. Within hours, he established and operated a DZ and delivered near 100% accuracy. For his actions, Dick Patton earned a Distinguished Flying Cross and presidential citation. 5 years later, another combat controller, James A. Jim Howell, successfully became the first human subject to eject live while testing the upward rotational supersonic B ejection seat. From an F-106B slicing through the air at 560 knots and 22,060 feet over Holloman Air Force Base, New Mexico, he was fired into the atmosphere, giving new meaning to the term test dummy. The intrepid combat controller stayed with the rocket-powered seat for 43 seconds until he passed through 14,000 feet, then separated and opened his parachute without incident, successfully capping a nearly 5-year test program. 40 years later, and a world away, a much younger combat controller set a different kind of record on November 14, 2001. It was a frozen night over Afghanistan. The temperature at altitude was in excess of minus 80 degrees Fahrenheit, and Staff Sergeant Mike Bain, a member of the 2-4, conducted the first ever Combat Halo Tandem Cargo Bundle Parachute Drop. Also executing this historic first were Delta Force Sergeants Major Chris and Bill, the same two operators who had accompanied Jay Hill on Anaconda and witnessed John Chapman's one-man stand, each with their own bundles. Mike was pushed off the ramp of an MC-130 combat Talon at 18,500 feet, strapped on top of a 3-foot diameter, 8-foot long, 528-pound tube crammed with his Delta team's rucksacks. Bill carried the team's food and water, and Chris more equipment. No surprise, their mission was to call airstrikes on a Taliban-controlled pass. It was a daring feat of courage. As audacious as it was, what Mike did after his parachute opened 6,500 feet above the enemy could be drawn from the pages of James Bond. Under canopy on his radio, Mike received his first strike aircraft, a flight of two F-15s, and managed to work up his first three targets by writing with a grease pen on the compass navigation board mounted on his chest. Also talking with his ISR platform, a Navy P-3, he was ready to destroy targets passed to him from the P-3 before he even hit the ground. Mike had the imagination, foresight, and expertise to plan for the possibility, an unprecedented innovation and application of air power. To many fellow black operators, it was the most impressive combat parachute jump in history. To a layman, it simply sounds unbelievable. The men landed in an isolated high-elevation mountain valley, with Mike hitting the intended impact point dead center. Mike and his Delta team then spent the next 24 hours climbing across two mountain summits with their 100-pound rucks. The enemy, knowing the mountainous terrain was inaccessible, assumed their passage was safe from American eyes and bombs. They were wrong. The team, with Mike on the radio, naturally, destroyed ammunition and fuel trucks on the first day of operations. That night, Mike had an AC-130 crater the road to slow traffic so the team could ensure they struck only Taliban forces. For 3 days, the Delta team and Mike denied all Taliban reinforcements between Kandahar and Kabul along their key supply route. 66 years into its history, CCT is just beginning to reach full potential. It's come a long way from Jim Stanford standing on the wing of a puddle jumper in the middle of enemy territory, pumping his own gas, to John Chapman fighting to save the lives of his 5 remaining SEAL teammates and another 18 men he'd never met. Yet they share a common brotherhood, an Air Force no one knew or even suspected existed. John's life and this book both end on the battlefields of Afghanistan in 2002. In the 17 years since those events, the 300 to 600 combat controllers that have comprised the force have earned hundreds of bronze stars with valor, 35 of the Air Force's 75 Silver Stars, 6 of its 9 Air Force Crosses, and its only Medal of Honor. From a uniformed force of approximately 500,000, combat control comprises 0.1% of the Air Force, yet accounts for nearly half of its Silver Stars and 2/3 of its highest award, the Air Force Cross. Those heroics are for chronicling in another volume of Combat Control's history. What is significant at the conclusion of this book is the impact this deadly shadow force has had on the Air Force and the nation. The future promises more of the same. In discussing that future, Brigadier General Mike Martin, the former commander of the 24th Special Operations Wing, the most decorated wing in the modern Air Force, explained why it's critical for CCT to continue to push into new frontiers. No one is tasked or organized to exploit and manage space into the battlefield. We are. You'd expect SEALs to own the maritime domain, but they don't. Same with Army Special Forces. I don't think anyone exploits those multiple domains more so than CCT. The contested nature of future environments will likely change what we do. Combat Control's abilities in denied and degraded environments allow us maneuverability unavailable to others. This in turn allows us to inform and shape the air and even space kinetic strike missions that will be required. Going forward, if I can put a special tactics team in suborbital low Earth orbit, I can infiltrate it within 45 minutes globally. Using Operation Anaconda as an example, the forces supporting CCT in conducting those strikes, the kinetics, hypersonics, and the like, must be able to keep up with our first-there forces. B-52s, a weapon Combat Control used extensively, can't keep up with that kind of rapidity. Footnote. For the first time in the history of Air Forces, any Air Force, the most decorated organization of a nation, is not a flying unit. There are no pilots in the 2-4 SOW. Regardless of future advances, today's combat controllers remain the deadliest individuals to walk a battlefield in the history of warfare, with the power and expertise to orchestrate the destruction of key strategic targets or hundreds of enemy at a time on any battleground onto which they step, as exemplified by Joe O'Keefe's stunning 688,000 pounds of bomb tonnage at Tora Bora. At the same time, and using their unique expertise, blending the world's mightiest air force with unequaled battlefield acumen and three-dimensional awareness, they are the first to deliver hope and salvation to suffering masses anywhere in the world at a moment's notice. Regarding the fight for Taker Gar, it is proportionally the most valorous battle in the history of the United States military. Of the 25 men on the mountain at sunrise, 13 would receive Silver Stars, 1 a Navy Cross, and 2, the Air Force Cross. And finally, 2 ultimately received Medals of Honor. But a battle sometimes referred to as Robert's Ridge, for the SEAL who inadvertently fell from a helicopter, more accurately centered on John Chapman, the man abandoned for dead, and who became the fulcrum by which the two opposing forces levered the larger fight. During his final hour, John was the deadliest man on the mountain summit battlefield on which he found himself, the lone combat controller, not because of air power, but by virtue of his spirit in the tradition of the American fighting man. A solitary warrior, one of his nation's finest, fighting as CCT have always done, even when integrated into a team, as a man with the burden of the lives of many others in his hands. After saving the lives of his 5 SEAL teammates at the cost of 2 mortal wounds, he held 24 enemy fighters at bay for more than an hour, until in his final moments, in excruciating pain, his body ravaged by 16 gunshot and shrapnel wounds and battered from hand-to-hand combat, he chose self-sacrifice over self-preservation, and with his last breath, delivered 18 comrades he'd never met into salvation. This has been a Hachette audio production of Alone at Dawn, Medal of Honor recipient John Shep, and the untold story of the world's deadliest special operations force. Written by Dan Schilling and Laurie Chapman Longfritz. Read by Kiff Vandenhoof. Produced and directed by Dennis Keo. Recorded by John Kavarik. Post-production by Ian Lehman and Jeremy Wesley. Production supervised by Elise Green. Alone at Dawn is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2019 by Dan Schilling and Laurie J. Longfritz. Audio production copyright 2019 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. Duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.